listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
You know, I think it's a noteworthy convergence that you're hearing about the National Book Award-winning writer George Packer tonight at the Downtown Central Library because, as we all know, you don't have to walk very far from this library or even this auditorium to see where the social compact has broken down in America today. The critical responses to George Packer's book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, is in itself a fascinating collection of writing. Among the earliest reviews pronounced George Packer's brilliant and innovative book as, quote, a foundational document in the literature of the end of America. If what Packer is examining is the ruins are the ruins of a modern imperium, then his reporting, his book, his voice, proclaimed the Independent in the UK, quote, will be one of the treasures that endures. Or this one, George Packer has crafted a unique, irresistible contraption of a book. Not since John Dos Passos' celebrated trilogy has a writer so cunningly plumbed the seething undercurrents of American life. George Packer is a storyteller first and foremost. He finds the big story in the small moment, just like the great American writer Raymond Carver, whose profile makes up one of the chapters in The Great Unwinding. If Carver was the Reagan-era writer who, as Packer reminds us, was the chronicler of blue-collar despair, then Packer can be considered one of the most important writers who explores experience itself as lived today by our fellow citizens. George Packer is the author of numerous books, including The Assassin's Gate, America and Iraq, as well as Blood of the Liberals, which won the 2001 Robert F. Kennedy Book Award. He's also the author of two novels, and his play, Betrayed, ran off Broadway for 5 months in 2008 and won the Lucille Lortel Award for Outstanding Play. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Some of you may have recently read his long piece titled, Is Amazon Bad for Books? And I won't give you a spoiler on that one, but I will say that buying your books from our library store tonight supports the work of the Los Angeles Public Library, and buying them on Amazon, well, it definitely supports Jeff Bezos. And in conversation tonight with George, another great writer, both reporter and novelist, is Hector Tobar, whose new nonfiction book on the story of the Chilean miners, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free, is forthcoming this fall. We're very excited about that. Hector is a seasoned journalist for the Los Angeles Times, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of the 1992 riots. He's also served as the Buenos Aires Bureau Chief and the Mexico City Bureau Chief, and he's currently a book critic for the Times. He is the author of three books, Translation Nation, The Tattooed Soldier, and the award-winning novel, The Barbarian Nurseries. It gives me great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming George Packer and Hector Tobar to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks so much for that, Louise, and it's great to be here. It's great to be here with Hector, who reviewed my book early on and got it in a way that no one had and made me think maybe there will be a readership for this book that understands what I'm doing. So I owe you. I'm just going to start by reading a short passage to get a little bit of the book out into the air tonight before we start talking about it. And this comes from right in the middle of the book. It's about one of the main characters, a guy named Dean Price, who grew up in the tobacco and textile region of North Carolina. His father was a fire and brimstone preacher who became a kind of bitter failure and was rather cruel to Dean growing up and ended up committing suicide. Dean had always wanted to escape the shadow of his father's failure and to become independent, mainly financially independent. So he ended up owning a chain of truck stops, gas stations, and fast food restaurants on Route 220 in North Carolina. And that became less and less satisfying to him. And at the point I'm going to read, he's about to make a big change in his life towards something completely different but related, which is to say to make his own fuel out of canola oil or waste restaurant oil. A two-lane asphalt road ran past the woods, white oak, shagbark hickory, Carolina ash. And in the shadows of the trees, a tobacco barn was year by year collapsing on itself, the metal roof sloping inward, pieces of bare siding hanging loose from nails. Nearby, a white clapboard house with empty windows squatted at the roadside, half smothered in tree branches and vines, while a fire-scorched, handwritten sign on the outside wall still advertised crush. Farther along, the road took a turn, and a tidy brick ranch house with a big satellite dish mounted on top stood in the golden sunlight of a red-brown field. Another bend, a gentle hill, deep woods again, then an abandoned metal warehouse alone in a clearing. The road straightened and flattened and came to a stoplight where a pair of strip malls faced each other, parking lots full of a Walgreens across from a McDonald's, Shell opposing BP. Another light, a shuttered car dealership, a vast scrapyard with a mountain of twisted metal and stacked timbers next door to a spinning mill that was being methodically gutted like a great whale and sold off one part at a time. Then downtown, the lonely little main street, a taekwondo studio, a government benefits office, a closed restaurant, a nameless corner store for rent, two pedestrians in four blocks, a Dollar General that marked the far end of town. On the other side, the country opened up at once, the road passing fields, corn planted on one, nothing on the next, weeds and clods of dirt. Then a residential development with two-story look-alike houses in neat rows laid out across someone's former tobacco farm. And beyond the subdivision, isolated on acres of grass behind a split-rail fence and a man-made lake, the supersized faux chateau of a celebrity NASCAR driver. The landscape Dean had returned to, where he planned to live out his life, was very old and also new, as particular as anything in America, and also as generic, as beautiful and as ugly. In his imagination, it had become a nightmare so profoundly wrong that he called it sinful, and he hated the sin more than any casual visitor or distant critic possibly could. Yet he also saw here a dream of redemption so unlikely and glorious that it could only fill the mind's eye of a visionary native son. Once, driving through Cleveland County, Dean happened to pass the hard-shell Baptist church that his father had once tried to get but failed, the failure that had broken his father's will. Dean had gone down with him to Cleveland County and heard the sermon that his father had given for his audition back around 1975, so that decades later, he still recognized the church. And he also noticed that there was now a fucking Bojangles right next door. For Dean, Bojangles had come to represent everything that was wrong with the way Americans lived, how they raised their food and transported it across the country, how they grew the crops to feed the animals they ate, the way they employed the people who worked in the restaurants, the way the money left the community. Everything about it was wrong. Dean's own business, gas and fast food, had become hateful to him, and he saw the error of his ways as his father never had. And the conjunction of his father's legacy and his own struck him with bitter irony as he drove past. He was seeing beyond the surfaces of the land to its hidden truths. Some nights, he sat up late on his front porch with a glass of Jack and listened to the trucks heading south on 220, carrying crates of live chickens to the slaughterhouses, always under cover of darkness, like a vast and shameful trafficking. Chickens pumped full of hormones that left them too big to walk. And he thought how these same chickens might return from their destination as pieces of meat to his floodlit Bojangles up the hill from his house. And that meat would be drowned in the bubbling fryers by employees whose hatred of the job would leak into the cooked food. And that food would be served up and eaten by customers who would grow obese and end up in the hospital in Greensboro with diabetes or heart failure a burden to the public. And later, Dean would see them riding around the Mayadan Walmart in electric carts because they were too heavy to walk the aisles of a supercenter, just like hormone-fed chickens.
Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, George, for that reading. Wonderful, wonderful book. It was my great honor to review it in the LA Times because I felt the spirit of a great writer in it and not just the history it had covered. And it does cover 40 years of history. And unlike many books of American nonfiction these days, there's no I in it. You never mention yourself. There's no, you don't enter the story. But there is a little bit of a personal subtext I sort of discovered, because the book starts in 1978. And that was an important year for both the United States and for you, right?
Well, for me, it was, you know, the momentous year that I graduated from high school,
right.
which alone would not be enough to justify beginning the book right. with that year. But I think a lot of things happened. It seemed like a totally forgettable year at the time, like in 78. What right. could be less interesting? It was Saturday Night Fever. It was the Bee Gees. But actually, it always seemed like the 60s were more interesting, and we had come a little too late. But the late 70s were when everything that has shaped our country today really got underway. And just to tick a few of them off, deindustrialization,
right.
The information revolution, the financialization of the economy with Wall Street beginning to take off, the rise of the new right. Newt right. Gingrich came to Congress that year, and so did a handful of other movement conservatives. It was and inequality, which is one of the big themes that are running through The Unwinding, begins to really spike in 1978. So it turned out to be maybe a more important year than 1968, even though when I was growing up, nothing seemed more important than 68.
Well, it was a year that was very, we're both native Californians, and it was the year that is momentous in all of our lives because it's the year that Proposition 13 passed.
I forgot to mention that.
Yes.
I got out of the public school system just in time as the door was closing, because after that, we all know, the system began to decline with
right.
the drying up of the revenue base. And so, yeah, the tax revolt, which was part of the grassroots conservative movement that was really taking off then, was a huge event.
Well, yeah, you were class of 78. I was class of 80. So I did get the impact. My high school in South Whittier actually closed in 1979, a year after Proposition 13. Tell me a little bit about the California that you grew up in. I mean, we're all nostalgic, right, about our youths, but there was, what was California to you? Now known as the Silicon Valley, of course, no one called it that then.
Right.
The area of orchard groves and suburban communities. What was California like for you in the mid-70s?
It was boring. It was it was pleasant.
Right.
It was incredibly nice. It was a middle class paradise.
Right.
There were poor people, and there were a few rich people. But there was nothing like the extremes that you see today in Silicon Valley. It was called the Santa Clara Valley.
Right.
Almost everybody sent their kids to public schools. Everyone I knew lived in the same roughly 2,000 square foot house. There was something kind of more egalitarian. Obviously, there were all the injustices of a less inclusive, less tolerant time. And it's one of the paradoxes that I've tried to work out through writing this book, that we've become more equal in some ways, socially,
yes.
and more inclusive, but we've become less equal in other ways, economically, and more stratified. And those two things have happened at the same time. It was a nice place to grow up and then a nice place to get away from. And when I started right. coming back as a reporter, I mean, my family was still there all that time, so I kept, going home, but I couldn't believe what kind of transformation had taken place. It was the gold rush. It still is. And it didn't seem like that was going to happen when I was a kid.
Now, there are three voices that are the sort of core stories in The Unwinding. And they're roughly our age, essentially, right? They're people who grew up in the 60s and 70s, came of age in the 80s and 90s. Dean Price, Jeff Connaughton, Tammy Thomas. Tell us about them and how is it that, you know, how they began this 40-year cycle of American history, what their place was, what their economic status was when we first meet them in the book.
Right. You're right that there's an age cohort in this book.
Yes.
I felt like I needed the generation that didn't, you know, that weren't the early boomers, didn't grow up in sort of the heyday of the post-war, but also weren't so young that they hadn't seen it. They sort of, their lives cross this marker that I rather arbitrarily draw, between the previous era and this era that I call the unwinding. So I needed people, in their 40s and 50s. I'm not sure I actually sought them out with that in mind, but I gravitated to people who had lived a lot, but who were still in the thick of life and still trying to figure it out and remake themselves because they kept getting pushed down and shoved aside and had to find a new way to survive and to thrive. So I also wanted people who were sort of representative of different parts of American life.
Exactly, yes.
Tammy Thomas, black woman from Youngstown, Ohio, spent her whole life there. Mm-hmm. And because of her age, she saw what happened when, in a 5-year period, all the big steel mills closed, late 70s, early 80s. 50,000 jobs in a rather small area disappeared. It was as if a million jobs in New York or Los Angeles had gone away. And Youngstown went into a death spiral. Mm. So she took me through her life by driving me around Youngstown and just pointing out, yes, my elementary school was there. Now it's just a overgrown field.
Wow.
That was the church. My mother's house was there before it was firebombed. Youngstown was Detroit in fast motion.
Wow.
The population left. The houses began to be torn down. And now it looks like someone in a suit that, you know, someone who lost 100 pounds and is still wearing the same suit. So she was, you know, she was a great guide to her own life, which is also the story of deindustrialization in the Rust Belt. Jeff Connaughton is about the same age. He's a kid from Alabama who in 1979, as an undergrad at Tuscaloosa, heard a young senator named Joe Biden give a speech. And he was mesmerized by it, not just by Biden, who he sort of saw as a Kennedy-esque figure, but by the idea of politics. So he told Biden, I'm going to follow you to the White House. And that's what he tried to do. He went after a stint on Wall Street in the 80s. His life is actually a very accurate tour through kind of the power centers of the last 30 years, from Wall Street to Washington.
Right.
He ended up being an aide to Biden on Capitol Hill and was part of the ill-fated 1988 Biden for President campaign, which some of you may remember, that ended in a plagiarism scandal.
Right.
It was one of the scandals of that year.
Just
after the Gary Hart scandal.
Yes. People remember much more because it had a blonde bombshell involved and a boat.
There was Donna Rice and the monkey business.
Yes.
But you know what? There's a book coming out later this year about that scandal that will make you realize you've misremembered it. We've all misremembered it. And it's quite an interesting revisionist view of it.
The Gary Hart scandal.
Donna Rice monkey business scandal. So Jeff Connaughton saw his dreams of the White House implode with this, stayed on with Biden, but began to realize Biden, to be blunt about it, was kind of a son of a bitch.
Right.
And at least to his staff, was not nurturing, supportive, took an interest, barely knew their names. So he got disenchanted with Biden, went off to the Clinton White House as an aide, and then the big turn in his life was when he left government and went through the revolving door and became a lobbyist.
Right.
And that allowed me to tell the story of how organized money has become the most powerful force in Washington. And he was far more successful and happy as a lobbyist than he ever was as a lowly political aide until, I don't know how far ahead we should go, but
when he starts off, he is very, let's start talk about them at the beginning. He's a very earnest person. He really believes in the political process. He's Like you say, he's swept up with Biden as this Kennedy-esque figure. There's this wonderfully intimate moment. You describe him going to his first political fundraiser, and he wanders into, he's in the Kennedy family library, and he finds Robert Kennedy's bound speeches, the actual manuscript of his speeches.
With Kennedy's handwritten editing on it.
And so, so he is someone who, I mean, I remember growing up in this America where the civics, you took seriously what you learned in your civics class. You know, it wasn't a joke. You know, people weren't cynical yet. You know, this is so much about the political process, even though Watergate, I guess, happened 4 years before your book begins, which was the beginning of people becoming more cynical about it. But he is very definitely a believer in American
and
democracy.
And he's a small-town Alabama boy, so he hasn't really imbibed the spirit of the 60s that actually I picked up to some degree growing up in the Bay Area. You might have here in Los Angeles. No, for him, politics was like he became a member of the National Student Union, and he became the University of Alabama's representative, and that's how he invited Biden to come to Alabama to give a speech. In fact, he had another senator to debate Biden on the SALT II treaty, which is something out of the deep past.
Yeah, anti-ballistic missile treaty.
Russians. Under Carter.
Yes.
And the Republican was a guy named Jake Garn from Utah, who at the last minute had to cancel. So Connaughton and a friend drove from Alabama to Washington to try to find Jake Garn and convince him to change his mind.
Right.
And he thought with a Mormon, it would be easier because Garn was a Mormon from Utah. Well, Garn really did have a conflict. But just imagine these two boys driving 10 hours and just trying to find where Capitol Hill was, and then walking into the Russell Senate office building.
Yeah, you didn't have to go through 50 metal detectors back then to get into the Capitol.
There's something...
You could actually get into the Capitol.
Yeah, sort of mythic about that.
Right.
So they wander the halls. Oh, my God, that's Ted Kennedy over there. Isn't that S.I. Hayakawa? You know, they were just having this... All of it was wonderful to them. Today, you go to Washington, and this miasma settles over you, like nothing is happening here. It is paralyzed. You feel it. But that was not his feeling.
Yeah, we actually passed treaties back then, right?
Yes, the Panama Canal Treaty was one of them. Yeah.
And then there's Dean Price. In a certain sense, he's in the middle. He's an entrepreneur. He has a chain of businesses that he tries to start. And he has a very typical middle-class American life. He gets divorced. He lives in Pennsylvania.
Except that he's from this very divorce and debt, bankruptcy.
Yes.
Classic middle class profile.
I don't have the divorce yet, but I have everything else.
You have to get divorced twice, though, to be up with Dean Price. Actually, no, three times.
I lost track.
Yeah,
yes.
Three times. But what makes him different and not at all sort of in the mainstream is that he's from this place, the Piedmont. It's the sort of chain of low hills stretching from Virginia along the Appalachian Mountains. And it's old, and everyone, you know, has lived there for centuries, and Scots-Irish. It's all, you know, that's the big influence. It's red America in political terms. And it's tobacco and textiles and furniture making. And when Dean was an adult in the 90s, all of those went away. So the entire economy, like Youngstown, except in a different way, the entire economy collapsed, and it became ridden with meth and crack and, you know, multiple generations on public assistance. And the inner city migrated to rural North Carolina and to white North Carolina. And so Dean was trying to be an entrepreneur with this. He has a sort of a 19th century Horatio Alger spirit. His heroes are Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. And he's trying to make a go of it. And it's hard because he's got an independent truck stop, and up the hill is Sheets Oil, you know, predatory discount gas chain. On the highway is Walmart, also selling gas and selling everything else. So he's trying to make a go of it against these big, you know, multinationals, and he can't make it.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing. You take these ordinary people, and also you made a conscious decision to enter inner America, away from the Washington, Los Angeles. You've gone to these places that are the heartland, broadly defined. And yet there, and you describe then the forces that are gradually tearing apart this social fabric. And you mentioned Walmart. And you have this wonderful short portrait of Sam Walton's life, in which you describe basically his business philosophy, which is, or his sort of take on human nature and his observation about human nature that makes him rich, which is people were cheap. They never pass up a rock bottom price. It was true in all the little white towns, in all the little all white towns around Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri after the war. It was true everywhere all the time. So he grasps this idea. His wife doesn't want to live in a big town, so he moves into these small towns and
Bentonville, Arkansas.
Right, where there's no Sears or Kmart to compete with.
And he had this inspiration that, you know, you could actually sell high volume to these folks in the sticks. They wanted products too. The post-war. They wanted, you know, to buy dishwashers and clothing and everything else. So he just undersold everybody. And he had this almost military strategy of moving across the landscape in a very concerted fashion, putting the stores strategically where they would, you know, either prevent another discount chain Kmart or Woolworths, or he would wipe out the local businesses. He would
sense the Main Street. He would take out a Main Street.
He would sense that this place is vulnerable. We can come in here and pretty much lay it to waste, and we'll become the go-to place for everything. And it was also done geographically, like spreading outward from Bentonville, Arkansas. You could almost do it like one of those maps of World War II with, you know, the tank divisions of the Germans and the Russians, with Walmart spreading outward from that little town in Arkansas to the middle of the country and then around the world. There are these 10 portraits. Maybe we can get to that, but he's one of the 10 celebrities who I thought should be in the book.
There's Oprah and there's Newt Gingrich. But the reason I think that what's different about your portraits is that they are an attempt to capture the spirit of this person. You know, not just the outline of their biography, but what their ethos is and what the impact of that is on the landscape. Because with Sam Walton, he undersells Main Street. And so you point out that when the little stores close, all these businesses, well, you know, that guy, the guy who ran the hardware store, well, he was the head of the Little League, right?
Yes.
And the guy who, you know, ran this other diner over here or this other store over here, he was the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, this is how, you're totally right about that, and you've actually made a connection I hadn't quite made in my mind, but it was Dean Price taking me on a walk through Madison, North Carolina, where he grew up, who was telling me, see that closed shoe store, see that restaurant? These guys were the pillars of this little town, and when they lost their businesses, we lost our foundation. And he didn't have to tell me Walmart had something to do with that, but the shrewd reader will hear Dean say that and remember from the Sam Walton chapter that was his strategy, and it was, you know, it was quite devastating.
But for Sam Walton himself, it's just this almost fairy tale that he's living. He has this belief, very simple idea, and he is going to, he doesn't see himself destroying America at all.
No, what he sees himself doing, and what others saw him, I mean, he was considered a hero throughout his life. Things turned against Walmart right after he died. It was as if, as long as there was this kind of down-home, self-deprecating country boy as a public face for Walmart, people thought Walmart, it's like poor folks make good. And it was giving folks in little towns, you know, good, you know, shoddy commodities at very affordable prices. What could be wrong with low prices? Well, it turns out it initiates a race to the bottom, where wages drop or flatten. And we all know the history of wage stagnation since the 70s. And manufacturing can no longer afford to stay in America because Walmart has such leverage that they can essentially command the price, the wholesale price. So they're driving manufacturing to China because Walmart is selling stuff so cheap. That all began to be Walmart's reputation like after 1992, which is when he died.
So you choose several celebrity portraits. There's how did you choose them? What was the logic behind these people that you decided to write? Jay-Z, for example, is
right.
another one.
And Robert Rubin, mm-hmm. Andrew Breitbart, LA's own Andrew Breitbart.
Yes. Well,
first of all, I wanted different sectors of our culture. So I wanted politics. Who is the most important political figure of my adult life? Well, the first thought would be Reagan or Clinton, maybe second, Obama. I think it's Newt Gingrich because,
right.
and I think history will really remember him. He shaped the politics of polarization. Nixon, of course, had a lot to do with introducing it, but Gingrich sort of codified it with, he would make these tapes and videos that he would hand out to other Republican
wow.
candidates, which essentially gave them a vocabulary for how to demonize your opponent
wow.
so that he wasn't just someone with a different philosophy. He was evil. And therefore,
right.
you could not work with him, and the voters would have to reject him. And it was this like this poison gas. It was like introducing poison gas in trench warfare. It changes everything. Suddenly, no one is safe, and it's going to escalate until everyone is dead on the battlefield. So I think Gingrich deliberately and quite successfully, brilliantly, came to Washington with the intention. He's sort of a 60s figure. Even though
right,
he's conservative,
exactly.
he's a radical. He wants to break down the institution. He has no regard for the hierarchy of the House of Representatives. He wants to humiliate the Speaker of the House. He used C-SPAN, which came out with cameras in the House the mm-hmm. same year he came to Congress. He used it brilliantly to get his message out to this growing sort of direct mail list of movement conservatives, and the rest is history. So I think Gingrich was really important. Oprah Winfrey, you know, who else could you say created the culture of confession and of
right.
sort of everything has to be public and of positive thinking? And if you only want it enough and if your soul is aligned with the universe, good things will come to you. And this became like, to me, This philosophy, it's sort of called the mind cure in an earlier American day in the
right.
in the turn of the century. It's a very American philosophy, and I think it comes to the fore when people feel that the normal ways of moving up are blocked to them.
Mm.
You know, holding down a steady job and raising your kids and, you know, having a secure retirement no longer works. Magical thinking starts to take over. Lottery type thinking. And Oprah's show kind of became a lottery where you guess what? Everybody gets a car.
Right.
So she's, you know, a hugely popular figure with an intense bond with her audience who I think had this slightly sinister, might be too strong a word, but.
Well, you have that wonderful sentence. She became so big she owned the letter O. You know, something like that.
And I think the other key sentence about her was at the end where because there was no random suffering,
mm-hmm.
because everything happens for a reason,
mm-hmm.
and your thoughts should be enough to bring good things to you, there was no
right.
more excuse. So her audience's lives are essentially stagnating
right.
at
right.
best, and they're having a harder and harder, they're losing their houses, but Oprah's message is essentially, what's wrong with you?
Well, she's the ultimate outsider. She herself is she's a black woman in an era when that's like two strikes against you in professional life. She's an abuse survivor
yep.
also.
She was a TV star who was very overweight. I mean, she broke every rule.
Right.
And I think the early Oprah, and I watched a lot of those recordings.
That's commitment.
Yeah, it was. You know, it's quite moving. There's this one episode where she is talking to abuse survivors, and there's this middle-aged white woman who starts to talk and is just very withheld and then finally begins to cry, and Oprah puts an arm around her, and then you realize it's Oprah who wants comfort from this woman, and then that was when she revealed that she too was an abuser, and it opened the floodgates, and it's a great thing. Oprah's book club was a great thing for books. Oprah did a lot of good, but she also, I think, filled the viewership with this, I think, a kind of misleading idea about how, you know, circumstances are more powerful than she would allow.
Right.
And with her, it was a kind of, if I can do it, you can do it. And why can't you do it?
Right. While you describe in great detail in the other chapters exactly the mechanics of how everything is falling apart and the how things are changing in America. But with these celebrity portraits, one interesting thing is you almost novelistically enter the point of view of the character. You sort of, you become a little bit of Oprah. You became Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich has this wonderful glee about him as he's destroying the establishment ideas in Congress in the 90s.
And Andrew Breitbart has this kind of TV generation casual way of talking, bombastic, but funny and sort of ironic about everything at the same. He knows that he's kind of pulling something over on people, but he's doing it anyway. I chose him as sort of the figure of media. Why Andrew Breitbart? You know, why not, you know, Bob Woodward or you know, Ted Turner or well, Breitbart, I think, saw the internet as the tool that it has now become early on and used it destructively to advance, you know, some, I think, very bad causes and to do it in a dishonest way, but utter disregard for the mainstream media. In fact, delight in watching them fall all over themselves trying to keep up with him or to rebut him or to justify their own work. And because the book really is about these institutions that I and you grew up with no longer working, Breitbart saw to the heart of the mainstream media and helped it commit suicide. That was his goal.
And also, to be clear, just so the audience knows, you did these mini profiles without interviewing any of these celebrities.
Yeah,
you had a nice critical distance from them.
You know, what I did was I read their words. I read, you know, all these interviews with them. A lot of them wrote autobiographies. I plowed my way through Jay-Z's autobiography, Andrew Breitbart's autobiography, Sam Walton's autobiography, got into the rhythm of their sentences, the words they use, and the way they see themselves. So I sort of reproduced that, and some of the phrases are lifted right out and are in the book, but with a bit of an ironic distance, because none of them see themselves clearly. They've become brands. They've become, this is what celebrity does in America. You start out as an obscure person. A lot of them, most of them did. They come from the same places as Tammy and Dean and Jeff. They become famous through talent and luck and drive. And then they become a persona, and that becomes a brand, and then an empire, and a kind of decadence starts to set in. And they, you know, the thing that made them great begins to seem like it's kind of rotting. And that's the trajectory of many of them. And to get that, I felt I had to use sort of the language that they all introduced. Each of them had their own language that they introduced into the culture.
And you had a direct literary influence in doing this. You have the John Dos Passos trilogy, which is about another era of American decline in the 1930s and what happened to the American spirit in that time. That obviously was a big influence in deciding to do that.
Well, you know, when I started to think about writing a book about 30 years, 35 years of American history, I was just sort of defeated at the outset. How would you do that without just, you know, having to plow through so much familiar material? Oh my God, the Iran-Contra, the Clinton impeachment. Right. We know all that. Why do I have to do it again? I finally realized what I wanted to do was not big history, but small history.
Intimate history,
which means ordinary people's history. But over this long period of time and in different parts of the country so that I could have a panoramic view intimately told. What model is there for that? I couldn't think of a single one in nonfiction. Always they're from the same place, or something brings them together, or it's all about one issue. I wanted something else. And finally, I was talking to my wife about it, and she said, well, you've been saying that Dos Passos did it. Why not do that in nonfiction? Mm. Of course, it becomes something different because it's a very different beast. But that gave me this sense of possibility. Like, yeah, you could tell these stories that never interlock but are part of the same big story because they're all living through the same history. All these characters are buffeted by the same big historical forces. And the celebrities are shaping sort of the conditions for their lives. So that was a real liberation to see that I could do something kind of novel.
Right. I think that there's a certain truth that comes when an artist takes on a truth in a moment of history. And especially in this passage you write, or this long set piece, it's, I think, more than one chapter about Tampa, where you begin with this almost Steinbeckian description of Tampa as the bubble is beginning to get ready to burst. You write that it grew and grew. It grew in order to grow, you know? And, you know, we lived that here in California, too. We had these exurbs that were, you know, were just growing for the sake of, where the Inland Empire was growing for the sake of growing. And so you take charge of it in this really big picture way, and then you find the intimate stories, like this amazing attorney among many other people in Tampa, Matthew Widener,
yeah.
Right? Who is a cultural conservative, NRA gun-owning guy who becomes a defender of people who have been foreclosed and writes this amazing letter that is a tribute, a kind of echo of Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Defending, you know.
He's a real madman. He's a wild thinker and talker and a little bit of a huckster. There's a strain of hucksterism in a lot of the stories.
There's a strain of hucksterism in America,
yeah,
so it's
yeah.
inevitable.
Dean Price, you know, once said to me, I don't know if I'm a truth teller or a snake oil salesman. Maybe a little of both. But Matt Widener, you know, he was what he called a door attorney, meaning whatever comes through the door, you take it. His office was right. on a kind of gritty street in downtown St. Petersburg, Florida, across the bay from Tampa, between a strip club and a bar. And so not a lot of glamorous business walked through the door. And then around 2007, the foreclosure cases started walking through the door because that Tampa was at the very front edge, as was Southern California.
Right.
of the housing bust, and it became this huge business for him. But it also became a cause, and he started a blog, and he became a crusader and rather well-known in those circles, and had this kind of apocalyptic vision that America, our legal system was collapsing because no one knew who owned the notes, and no one could establish the chain of custody of the house. And
right.
And on and on. So he was a really wonderful guide to the housing story. And Tampa it's actually like four or five chapters more toward the end of the book because
right.
I think, yeah, the story of boom and bust, of housing as a commodity, and of the exurban way of life, which I think began to end with the financial crisis. That was an important story to tell, and there's no one character in Tampa. It's a whole gallery of characters.
And so I imagine you spent a lot of time driving around these places in Tampa. What was that like, you know, getting to know that, to see that?
Just disorienting, and almost a nausea sets in because you never know where you are. There's no landmarks. First of all, there's no hills. There's no changes of elevation. And there's just 8-lane roads with stoplights every half mile, and then endless chain stores and big box retailers along the side of the road. And there's no there, as someone said. Gertrude Stein, yeah. It's a very disorienting place. And the lack of a community is what you really feel.
Lack of a community.
Yeah, people are on, well, this is true throughout the book, but nowhere more than in Tampa. People are really on their own. There's just no structures like a union or a civic or neighborhood association or a church or a business that is kind of becomes your life.
Right.
It's very transient. People come and go. The subdivisions, housing is an investment there. People don't know their neighbors. And there's a lot of suspicion and fear of fraud and scams. And there are a lot of scams.
Right.
So it's... it's a kind of frightening place, actually.
And
with some lovely people.
With some lovely people. And it's conveyed in all of its beauty and strangeness in your book. So what happens to the three main, for lack of a better word, ordinary people that you follow, American heartland residents, Dean, Jeff, and Tammy? What happens to them as time transpires? They all undergo amazing transformations.
Yeah, I mean, American history happens to them all, and they all become more and more aware of larger forces at work in their lives. And it all converges on the year 2008. Mm. So if 1978 is sort of the initiation of it all, 2008 is where everyone has a reckoning. Jeff Connaughton is a millionaire in 2008. The lobbying firm he works for has been sold to a global conglomerate, and they've all earned out, you know, and been paid very handsomely. And he's just doing great. And then he begins to pick up little clues about this housing problem, but ignores it. And as he said to me, it was greed.
Wow.
He starts buying property in Mexico and then in Costa Rica, and then he buys more property in Costa Rica with the idea of flipping part of it. And he becomes a flipper, like the people in Tampa.
Wow.
And he doesn't take his money out of the stock market where he's got it. And with September and Lehman Brothers, he loses half his net worth. It's just collapses. And he had been kind of warned by people. And so, you know, no one to blame but himself. But he begins to think that maybe... you know, he'd been part of something wrong as a lobbyist. He'd been part of the system that created the conditions for this financial crisis, where the banks and the other big corporate interests began to own Washington and to write the rules and regulations in their favor. His old boss, Biden, becomes vice president that year. And Connaughton becomes the chief of staff to the guy who takes Biden's Senate seat, Ted Kaufman in Delaware. And Connaughton and Kaufman decide that their mission is going to be to make Wall Street pay, both by getting the Justice Department the tools to prosecute the top executives and by writing really tough reform legislation that's going to actually restore the Glass-Steagall Act, repealed under Clinton, and break up the big banks. He spends 2 years trying to do that. In his view and in others, it doesn't happen. And he finally decides he's done with Washington. And he goes out in a spectacular way. He actually sort of almost publicly burns all his bridges, which people in Washington don't do. They always want to be viable. Mm. You know, you don't write an op-ed and name names. Mm. So... He is now living a quiet life in Savannah, Georgia. He wrote a memoir called The Payoff, and I think there will be another phase of Jeff Connaughton's life, but right now he's a recovering Washington insider.
Right, and Tammy?
Well, around the same time, a little earlier, Tammy had one of the last blue-collar jobs in Youngstown. She was working on an auto parts assembly line, which allowed her to raise her three kids in this increasingly hellish place safely and to get them educated and then to get them into college and to get them out. An amazing feat, really. As she would say, though, I just did what I was supposed to do. Her job and most of the jobs in that factory were sent to Mexico in 2006, and the workers were given these buyouts and her pension started to disappear. So in midlife, she had no career anymore. She had no support. She didn't know what to do. And she became a community organizer.
Right.
And that's what she was doing when I met her a few years later. So she actually was becoming conscious of the larger forces that had hollowed out Youngstown and trying to train the people she knew and neighbors and friends to become actors in their lives, not to just be the passive, you know, objects of these big forces. So a very interesting turn in her life. She went from being a factory worker to a community organizer. Dean Price went into biodiesel, as I mentioned, and opened America's first biodiesel truck stop from farm to pump, from the canola seed to the fuel pump. And it didn't really work. It just couldn't quite monetize it. And his partnership fell apart. He went bankrupt. He was in a bad way. I mean, he was thinking about suicide at one point, which would have been the terrible, you know, fate of that his had claimed his father. But Dean is such a dreamer and such a visionary in a modest sort of way that he just wasn't going to give up. And he's still out there on the biodiesel hustings. But what he's doing now is, instead of using canola oil, he's collecting. He and his partner go around in a truck and collect the waste oil from the fast food restaurants that he used to own and the barbecue joints, and selling it for biofuel and giving part of the profits to the public schools all around North Carolina. And so he's got this sort of for-profit business that has this nonprofit side to it, and it's his long-term goal is to make the fuel for the school buses,
right,
and save the money and save the environment and all the rest of it. And it's a great idea, and I think it's actually been working. What Dean has going against him is America's new energy boom, because. His whole vision depends on high gas prices. He cannot make biofuel work unless the cost of number two diesel goes up to like $5 a gallon. And it's just not there, and it's not going to get there because of the shale oil and gas boom.
But he has this amazing hope, and you have this wonderful scene where you're driving through the countryside in small towns, and he sees this waste everywhere that he can eat, and he looks at it like this bonanza. He believes that there is this bonanza waiting to be discovered.
He's a positive thinker. He's got the mind cure philosophy. His hero is Napoleon Hill, who was like in the early 20th century, a sort of the first how to succeed in business. And it's by Napoleon Hill's famous quote is, if the mind can conceive it and the heart can believe it, then you can achieve it. And you can just hear that coming out of, you know, Tony Robbins' mouth or Oprah Winfrey's mouth. And Dean really has, I mean, Napoleon Hill's works are his Bible, along with the Bible. And he sees these fallow tobacco fields. And he's got all these 19th century texts. There's a sermon called Acres of Diamonds by this late 19th century minister, and it's just all about how all around you are where the diamonds are. Just look at your feet. So all around Dean is what? Fallow fields, you know, failed businesses, and this, you know, crappy fast food that everyone eats. And he just sees riches in it.
And all that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and for me, it's the country and history has taken away so much from these three people, but it hasn't taken away their sense that they can reinvent themselves. They hold on to that. And they do seek ways to reinvent their lives.
And when people say, oh, it all sounds so depressing, I say, well,
it's not. No.
You know, read the book. I don't think you'll be depressed. You'll see starkly, you know, that our middle class life has really fallen very, very far in a generation. And the institutions that used to support it are all in various states of decay. But there's this resilience in these individuals that is hopeful. It's not, I don't take it as a substitute for some larger structural change. That's a
bigger problem. And I don't have the answers that, you know, I wish I did. But I do see, and I'm sure there are deans and TAMIs all over the country, people sort of recognizing there's something fundamentally wrong with the social order that we have today. And the elites don't have the answers. The solutions are not coming from New York, Washington, or even Silicon Valley. And we didn't mention there is a Silicon Valley character as well,
yes.
Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal. It's, you know, people have to figure things out for themselves.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, George. And with that, we'll open it up to all of you. Thank you. There are microphones. And if you could also form a question, you know, keep it to a question. Thank you.
I'll try and do that, Hector.
Thank you.
As somebody who grew up in small towns in the Midwest and lived in Tennessee and Texas before coming out here, I was curious that all your sort of key characters were within the East Coast, Eastern time zone. And I'm just also interested, there were no Latinos there, with Hector up here in particular, and his writing about those cultures that are going to become a majority of California, for instance. Where do the mountain states, where do the Midwest, where does Texas, the upper Midwest, where does Latino America fit into the stories you told?
Well, Tammy Thomas is from Ohio, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the Midwest. And Peter Thiel is from Silicon Valley, and so you've got the West Coast. The immigrant issue is a really serious question about the book, and it's very hard to orchestrate a book like this. You don't have a cast of characters in mind at the outset and then just find them and find the niche that they fit in. It's much more fluid and just constantly shifting. But toward the end, I realized there's no major immigrant character in this book. There's an Indian woman who owns a motel in Tampa and who kind of, against all the odds, still believes in the American dream, even though, you know, HSBC is trying to nail her to the wall in foreclosure. But I think it's a valid point that there's a missing picture of that. Because if you talk about the last 35 years, that's a huge part of the story. I guess all I can say is, you know, there isn't room for everything. One review of my book had this long list of things that were missing, and it was like, Americans living abroad, Americans working in philanthropy. Obviously, the Latino experience is a much bigger missing piece, but a book is not an encyclopedia. And in this book, by the time I got to the end, I realized I can't find room for that. So it's a missing piece. And so are the mountain states. I wish I'd been able to find somebody, you know, in Montana, but I didn't.
Yes, over here. Yes.
Yes. When you began, you talked about the two themes that had happened in the past 40 years. The structures sort of falling apart while liberty or equality was opening up in many ways. When I looked at my want ads for my first jobs, there were still women and men. Now, I'm assuming that what the decline or in obvious discrimination based on sex is one of the things that you are talking about. How does that play into your book? Because that wasn't something I heard at all other than at the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that in Tammy Thomas's life, what you see is the rise of the woman as breadwinner. I mean, she's responsible for herself. There's no man taking care of Tammy. And in fact, at the factory where she worked for 20 years, the majority of jobs were held by women. And this is an assembly line. So it's a male-seeming industry that had become dominated by women. But, you know, in some ways, I am the victim of my characters in the sense that if I were to orchestrate a story that was more directly about that theme. It would be hard to do with the characters I'm writing about. And I have to say, as a writer, my first commitment is to them and to the need to be as, you know, as honest and full as I can in treating their lives. If I begin to think, well, what's missing, and have I directly taken up this or that issue, there's almost no place in the book for that, because the book is not written in a voice that can then say, while Tammy was working on the assembly line, right, middle-class women were moving into the professions but kept hitting the glass ceiling. There's just no way to do that without violating sort of the terms of the book.
Right, because it's organized like a novel, and because working as a novelist slash journalist, you are searching for intimacy. You're searching for intimate portraits of people. And larger issues covering the totality of something doesn't always lend itself to that kind of work.
And I guess I'd add that, you know, this book doesn't purport to be the history of the United States, right, over the last 35 years with a chapter for every major theme. It does have an organizing concern, which in a phrase is the decline of the social contract.
Right.
And that is what these stories all sort of get at. And whether you're a woman, a man, black, white, Latino, that is going to affect you.
Right.
As it rises above race, gender, and even class to some extent. And it's a sort of countrywide and national thing. So that's part of what shaped the choices I made.
Right. Another question over here? Yes.
How did you find these characters? How did you find these people?
Yeah.
Oh, good question.
I know it's tough to know. Characters sounds as if they don't exist. And yet when they're in a book, they do kind of become characters.
Right.
Well, partly by luck and partly by some design. I'll take each of the three. In the case of Tammy, I wanted one of the main characters to be a woman, and I wanted one of the main characters to be from the Rust Belt. So I actually started asking people who were from Ohio and Michigan and the industrial Midwest, do you know a woman in the Rust Belt who sort of has become, is working to rebuild a community that, you know, fell into, you know, deindustrialization. And her name came up in several conversations, just kind of like, yeah, this woman, Tammy Thomas, who works at the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative. I went out to see her without any idea of what I would find and whether she would be willing to do it and whether she would be the right person, because there are not that many people who, A, are willing to let you into their life to that extent. It's a matter of weeks, in some cases months of time together, staying at their houses, going out to dinner, driving around, asking impertinent questions. Tammy once said, you ask too many personal questions. You know, she gave me a real stiff arm. That's just the nature of it. And she turned out to be more dynamic, inspiring, interesting. Her life was more, both more tragic and more inspiring than I'd ever imagined. So I got lucky. Dean Price I met while working on a New Yorker piece about a congressman from that part of the country, and his office just said, oh, there's this guy who has a biodiesel truck stop. We're trying to get a stimulus grant for him. So you should go talk to him. And I did, and immediately, as soon as he opened his mouth, I knew that this is a spellbinding talker, a guy who has a way of making everything into a parable. You know, he sees his life sort of as a kind of a series of epiphanies, a spiritual journey. And he was just fun and great to talk to. And then Jeff Connaughton, he also I met through a New Yorker piece about insider trading. He was like a minor source for me, but as I talked to him, I realized, my God, his whole career covers the period of the book and takes you through the revolving door in Washington. And I knew from the start that Washington had to be a part of the book. So I took a long time to convince him to participate, because he wanted to write his own book, and he was savvy to the media as a former Washington guy, and it was not easy, but in the end, he capitulated.
Now, over here, on this side, yes?
You, You've been asked a lot of questions that have essentially wanted you to explain and justify the book you didn't write, but let me give you one more.
I knew this would happen in L.A. somehow.
You carry the story, obviously, with personal anecdotes and with celebrity profiles. That makes it a very accessible kind of a story, and in a weird kind of a way, entertaining. But do you think that it might, because of that, the culture of entertainment, that it might be, to quote you, emblematic of the kind of decadence that's setting in?
Wow.
Oh, man. Is my book decadent? Is that what you're asking? No. No, it's not. I mean, my book is a really demanding book because to read it, you have to be able to suspend the ordinary desire to have a story told to you in a linear and
right.
and monolithic way. You begin the book with a prologue, 2 pages, in a kind of omniscient voice. Then you have a mashup of newspaper headlines, song lyrics, ad slogans, quotes from the year 1978. Then you meet Dean Price and you hear about his early years. Then you have a little sketch of Newt Gingrich. And then you meet Jeff Connaughton. And then you have a sketch, I think this is a sequence, of Oprah Winfrey. And then you meet Tammy Thomas. By page 50, like 5 stories have been introduced. And I think it takes, a certain kind of reader who senses something is being established here that's going to add up. It's going to come together. Some of the parts will not be as great as the whole, but it takes a while. And you're not led by the hand. You're made to wait and to sort of take it on faith. It's not a dry policy book. I made a deliberate decision that this book would be narrative. It would not be prescriptive. It wouldn't tell you what's wrong with America and how to fix it. You've all read those books. Some of them are good, some of them are not. They all are easily forgotten. You just, you either agree with it and forget it, or you disagree and forget it. I wanted to sink deeper into you, into your nervous system, and get you at that level so that you wouldn't be so likely to forget it. And that, too, is a demanding experience as a reader. So the answer is no.
Over here, yes?
I was going to ask the question how you met the three, but now that the book is out, how did they, the main three characters, how have they taken it, and what is your relationship with them now?
Well, I'm really relieved and happy to say it's good. I made that possible by showing it to them before it was published. Not the whole book, but their parts of it. And asked them to tell me what they thought, what was right, what was wrong, and if there was anything they really didn't want in it to tell me, and I would take that seriously. So we had these intense conversations. And that was risky for me to do because, what if they said, I don't want any of this published? We'd have a real problem. Mm-hmm. There were some hairy moments, but in the end, I think they each became, I think I got to know them better through those conversations and even rewrote some, especially of Tammy's stuff, in a way that was truer to her life than I had been able to get. And so, I don't think they're all thrilled with everything I've written about them. I know that Dean went into a 2-week depression after reading his, and then I was sending him these emails saying, Dean, come on, just call me. Let's talk about it. We've always been able to talk. And finally he called me and just asked me to take one little thing out. And I guess nothing is off the record anymore, but it was so funny because this story of his life is full of setbacks and bankruptcies. And the one thing he wanted to take out is that passage I read about sitting on his porch with a glass of Jack had originally said, or a lit dube. That is no longer in the text. And I just kind of was charmed that the one thing Dean thought might make people really think ill of him was that he was smoking a joint. So wow. That's out.
And in fact, Dean and Tammy met each other at my house because I invited them to a book party, and they stayed at my house. And it was kind of wild to have these two figures who, for me, always been separate, and you know, they didn't know each other. I almost wanted to keep them apart in a weird way. Here they were sitting at my table together, and it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. So it doesn't always end that way, but in this case, everyone seems to be at peace.
I think we have time for two more questions. Where is over here? Yes.
Hi, class of 78. Just thinking about your thesis about decline, do you think this decline is permanent or more enduring than other declines? Because if you think about African Americans at the end of Reconstruction, they might have said, we had a social contract, now there's decline. They get some of that back in the New Deal in World War II, and now it's in decline. So is there something about this moment, this decline, that seems more enduring or more permanent and more dangerous to you than other declines and resurrections?
That's a great question. And in my prologue, I mentioned those other declines, which I say each led to some new cohesion, some remaking of the social contract. It's very hard to answer because I don't have a crystal ball, and I hate talking about the future. I think journalists do that too often. What worries me is that the normal ways in which these things begin to repair themselves don't seem to be working anymore. We had two big shocks in the last decade. We had 9/11 and we had the financial crisis. And those were both of them almost on the scale, less so 9/11, but of Pearl Harbor and the Great Depression. And those two events really did send America in a new, and I think a more fair and a more, a direction that had more opportunity. And now every shock seems to leave us in the same place. The institutions don't begin to renew themselves. And the one institution that seems, or whatever you want to call it, that seems to be thriving is the internet. And a lot of young people, especially in Silicon Valley, think that's going to replace, you know, traditional schools, libraries, unions, newspapers, books, all the things that I think were part of the success of a middle-class democracy. I don't see that happening. I think of the internet as almost accelerating some of these trends, concentrating more wealth in fewer hands with more and more people working for free. So I don't, while I'm encouraged when I think about the people I wrote about, I don't see structures emerging that can actually make large-scale permanent change. You know, I think Obama achieved some things, especially with the Affordable Care Act, that are of great significance, but government no longer seems to work in that way. That was like a Hail Mary that just barely made it. I was in the Senate chamber during the debates over the ACA, and it was like watching someone just crawling across the finish line, half dead at the end of a marathon. And now it seems to be imperiled every week. It's as if, you know, first by the Supreme Court, and then it passed that barrier, and now it's back to elections and the public, and we don't seem to have a politics that can rise to the occasion. So I guess that's a long way of saying I fear, yes, this is a more permanent decline, but I'm not sure.
And our last question is over here.
Obviously, class of 78 think alike, because I was going to ask something similar to that. But hearing you talk about your book, which I'm very much looking forward to read, reminds me of Barbara Tuchman's The Proud Tower, where she used, I think, 6 or 8 portraits of prominent figures to describe the closing decades of the 19th century and then ended in World War I. So having talked about the possibilities or lack of possibilities for healing, I guess I just ask a traditional question of an author. Now that you are published and obviously promoting this book, is there a story inside of you that you feel might be bubbling up to the surface that you want to tell next?
God, I wish it were so. This book really hollowed me out. I mean, it was exhausting. It was years in the making, and now it's years in the selling, which is an alarming thing to happen. And I just am still in it. My head is still in it. My heart's still in it. It's everywhere I look. Like just a month ago, I wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Amazon, and I didn't mean for this to happen, but it ended up being a piece about the unwinding.
Right.
It turns out the book business and the business of reading and publishing books is kind of going the way of the larger economy. It's like there's these blockbusters at the top that are getting more and more money and attention and effort by the publishers. There's this massive of unedited titles being thrown out there by Amazon's various platforms. The midlist book, which is the kind of book Hector and I write, which is like the hard to sell, you know, not going to sell a ton of copies, but might last, might have some enduring value. Those are the books that are harder and harder to get a publisher for, to get an advance for. That looked suddenly like the economy in a weird way, with the middle class contracting. And so I might be in that state of mind where everywhere I look, I see the same thing, which is probably not a good... it's probably time to move on to something else. I don't yet have that something else. If anyone has any ideas, please let me know.
And thank you. And you can enjoy your journey still into the unwinding by buying a copy outside, and George will be there to sign them. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.